The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana, bringing Montanans together to learn and reflect for 40 years, and by listeners like you.
How did Billy Collins get involved with this collection of poetry?
His first book came out from the University of Arkansas Press, and it was chosen by the esteemed poet Miller Williams, who read it, Bill Clinton's second inaugural. And I think Collins felt kind of an obligation then to Miller Williams and the press. And Miller Williams passed away a couple years ago, and the press then asked Billy Collins if he would step in and edit a new series in honor of Miller Williams. And so for the last 2 years, Billy Collins has edited this series. He selected 5 books each year to publish. And this year I was lucky enough that one of the books he selected was mine.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast devoted to authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman. Joe Wilkins is here, and we're talking about his collection of poetry titled When We Were Birds. This collection includes a series of poems written to your son, mm-hmm. both before and after he was born. How did you get started with that?
Yeah. When we were expecting, my wife was doing all this important biological work, and I sort of felt left out in some ways. You know, I thought like, oh, I need to make sure I'm involved as much as I can be. And I was trying to do that in many of the usual ways, but as a writer, one of the other ways was trying to reckon with this new thing in our lives on the page. And so I started doing that, and it became kind of almost a journal. I would try to write one a day. And there's many of those that didn't make it into the book, many of those notes. Wherever we were, wherever my thoughts were going, whatever was happening, is kind of a record for him and to him. And then after Walter was born, our son, there was just no other thing to write about. You know, I'm always writing about what I'm seeing, what matters to me, what's important to me, what I can't quite figure out. And becoming a father, becoming a parent, having this new life in your home is something really to reckon with and to try to figure out, and something that I don't think I'll ever fully figure out, but writing helps me do that. It helps me understand, and it helps me see us from a distance and see us up close, and so I really value it for that.
The first poem in the collection also gives the book its title, so let's hear that one.
Yeah. So this is called My Son Asks for the Story About When We Were Birds. When we were birds, we veered and wheeled. We flapped and looped. It's true, we flew. When we were birds, we dined on tiny silver fish in the watery hearts of flowers. When we were birds, we sistered the dragonfly, brothered the nightwise bat, and sometimes when we were birds, we rose as high as we could go, light cold and strange. And when we opened our beaked mouths, sundown poured like wine down our throats. When we were birds, we worshiped trees, rivers, mountains, sage knots, rain, gizzard rocks, grub-shot dung piles, and like all good beasts and wise green things, the mothering sun. We had many gods when we were birds, and each in her own way was good to us, even winter fog, which found us huddling and salal or silk tassel, singing low sweet songs and closing our blood-rich eyes and sleeping the troubled sleep of birds. Yes, even when we were birds, we were sometimes troubled and tired, sad for no reason, and so pretended we were not birds and fell like stones, the earth hurtling up to meet us, our trussed bones readying to be shattered, our unusually large hearts pounding for nothing. Yet at the last minute we would flap and lift, and as we flew shudderingly away, we told ourselves that this falling we would remember. We thought we would always be birds. We didn't know. We didn't know we could love one another with such ferocity that we should.
Did that come from an actual question you got from your son?
Yeah. He asked me to tell that story one night. I try to tell the kids a story at night before bed, and often they want a story about something I did when I was a boy, you know, when I made bad choices or when I got in trouble or things like that. And that night, Walter was sort of half asleep, half awake, and he was in bed, sort of eyes just about to drift, and he asked for a story, and so I said, what kind of story? And we'd been talking for a while, and finally he said, tell me the story about when we were birds. And immediately I just thought, oh my goodness, how can I possibly tell that story? But I have to tell that story, and I don't remember exactly what story I told that night, but it was a story trying to make sense, you know, just about when we were birds. And the next morning, immediately, I started sort of rewriting it and working it and shaping it into this poem.
And you also shaped it into an essay that was published in Contrary Magazine. And I brought a copy of that. Yeah. And I'd really like you to read it.
Yeah. I'm so glad you found this. Contrary is a smaller magazine, and I was really pleased that they published it. I thought they presented it really well. But it's also a strange essay. It's an essay written as a one-act play, and I've never done that before, but I felt sort of the back and forth when Walter and I were talking that night was so interesting and so intriguing to me that I wanted to capture that. I wanted to make the dialogue as full as possible. And I also have long, long loved Tennessee Williams and his intricate stage directions, which read to me like poems. And so I thought, I was like, oh, that might be a space to sort of play with the texture, to sort of try to direct what's happening. So it's called When We Were Birds, an essay in one act, and it's got an epigraph from Hamlet, Pray You Love, Remember. Characters, the man, the boy, time and place. Evening, a darkened room lit by a lone lamp on a table or a dresser. Maybe a braided rug at center stage, a rocking chair in a corner, a few stuffed animals or toy trucks off to the side, but nothing clear, nothing resolving fully from shadow. Now the man, standing by the lamp, clicks it off and the shadows deepen. The only illumination, the light fading through curtains in the back of the room. The curtains a pale green or a translucent blue. Any color, really, which gathers the last light. And the man slowly crosses the room and sits on the floor, leaning up against the boy's small bed. The boy crawls out of bed then. He is only 5, but tall, substantial. One of those who seems perpetually older than he is, his surprising boyishness delighting and frustrating in equal measure. And the boy sits on the man's lap, and the man wraps his arms around him, and the boy, wearing 4 pajamas, an old t-shirt that hangs to his knees, curls up as well as he can in the man's lap and is still facing the audience. Light slowly illuminates the boy's face, and for the evening shadows, this is the first time either of the characters' faces has clarified. While the man looks stage right out over the boy's head, the boy continues to look at the audience, stares really, as children do, his face serious, intent, unapologetic. The boy. But how does the baby get inside the mom's tummy? The man. Well, bud, now, the boy, interrupting, insistent. And how do we die? I mean, we're alive and then we just die. How is that? The light shifts here, the angle lengthening through the curtained window in the back, the boy's face, however, remains sharp and clear. Perhaps, too, there should be some rising nighttime sound, the size of an old house, the susurrus of a city, a gentle wind whirring the windows, the man stroking the boy's head, his voice slow, careful. Gosh, bud, you're full of questions tonight. The boy. Like grandfather from the pictures, I mean, how did he just die? He was alive, right? The man. Yes. The boy. And now he's dead. The man. Yes. The boy. What about when he was alive? The man. When he was alive. Here the boy turns to look stage right, his face profiled in shadows as the man's was, and the man turns and faces the audience, the light rounding and softening his features. When he was alive, well, when he was alive, he took me once to town. We lived a long way out in the country. The boy, like 100 miles. The man, yes, like 100 miles. It took us 2 hours to get to town. We were in the old Ford pickup and had a load of cold ewes in the back. I remember we had the radio on to a country station, KGHL, classic country. I remember that. And the windows were down, and I watched how your grandfather hooked his arm out the open window, and I tried to do the same, though I was too small and had to stretch a long way, and after a while I let my arm drop back into my lap. Your grandfather drove us to the stockyards, which were along the river, and we backed up to the chute and unloaded the ewes. The stockyard smelled of manure and straw, and the yard was busy with trucks and pickups and the bleats of sheep and cattle. And after that, we went out for a hamburger, and the boy, was it a hamburger or a cheeseburger? The man, a cheeseburger. I imagine it was a cheeseburger. Yes, we ate cheeseburgers at the Kit Kat Cafe, and somewhere your grandfather bought me a helium balloon. I don't know where. I can't imagine they sold balloons at the stockyards, or the cafe, but I had a balloon, a bright blue one, and I, living so far out in the country, I hadn't had many balloons as a boy, at least helium ones that floated. It was in the truck with us as we drove back the way we came, back through town, that when we stopped at the grocery store, there was an IGA we always stopped at. I accidentally let the balloon go. I remember it lifting into the sky, which was gray and white and blue, all those colors at once, but the balloon was only one color, only blue, and it drifted up above us, over the parking lot and into the sky. The boy, did you cry? The man, yes, I did. The boy, was grandfather sad? The man, I don't know. Maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. That trip to town is one of the only things I remember about him. Here, the two switch once more, the man looking stage right, the boy staring at the audience. I mean, he died when I was only 9. I didn't know him, not really. The boy, his face twists. But I'm only 5, and I know you, you're my dad, and he was your dad, and what do you mean you didn't know him? I don't understand. What do you mean, Dad? What do you mean? The boy tries to pull away from the man to sit up in the man's lap and look at him, but the man holds the boy all the more tightly, almost too tightly. Eventually, the boy quits struggling and looks back at the audience, his face a knot of worry and fear. The man, I don't know. I'm sorry. Maybe you're right. Maybe I knew him then, but not later. Yes, maybe I knew him then and have only forgotten about knowing him, because it's true he came to me there in the parking lot and knelt down so I could look right at him, even though I was so much smaller. He was tall and big across the shoulders and had curly hair, like you do, though his was black, very black. And he knelt down like I never remember him and told me my balloon would float up and up and someday come down and another little boy would catch it and that little boy would be my friend. The boy, his eyes wide, a shocked smile breaking across his face. He moves his hands now as he talks. And did it? Did it come down, the balloon? Did the other little boy bring it to you? Was he your friend, like grandfather said? Did you play trucks? What was his favorite color? Was it red? Was it blue like you? Did you climb a tree together one time and decide never to come down? The boy waits a moment, and when there is no answer, the man still staring off stage right, the boy settles back against the man's chest and smiles. The boy, I bet you did. I bet the two of you are friends, just like grandfather said. The light shifts again and dims, the shadows fading into blackness, and the wind rises outside the house in earnest now, and for a time we hear only the wind. The boy closes his eyes, opens them, closes them again. The boy, what else did grandfather say? The man, a thin wire in his voice of grief, anger. I don't remember. The boy, yes, you do. The man, no, I don't. The boy, eyes still closed. Well, I do. The man, incredulous. You do? The boy, yes. The man, tell me then. The boy, yawning. He said, the boy's voice fades into the sound of the wind, only to rise again. The boy, grandfather said, see the birds. See the birds. They were up there with a balloon. Again, the boy pauses, the wind rushing in. The boy, grandfather was saying, he was telling the story. Tell me the story. His head heavy against the man's chest, the boy drifts in that liminal space, the world, both world and dream. The man isn't crying, not yet, but he seems to tremble, as if any moment the whole of him might spill, and the room fades, the window, the lamp, the rug, even the bed, all disappear into shadow, though a sourceless light rises beneath the man and the boy, as if they have indeed entered another world, as if they can fly now through the dark, as if through the boy's insistence the man finally remembers, can indeed feel his father's hand on his small shoulder, can sight along the clean line of his father's upstretched arm and see the circling birds, black and together shifting against the sky, shifting with a sudden, severe grace of birds. The boy, tell me the story about when we were birds.
You've been listening to Joe Wilkins read from his essay titled When We Were Birds, which is also the title of his latest collection of poems. This is The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman. You can listen again or share this conversation with a friend from our blog, which you'll find online at mtpr.org/twq. Links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages are also there. Our podcast recently migrated to another location in cyberspace, so if your feed goes missing, please reconnect with us at mtpr.org. After a short break, we'll be back to talk about Joe's process of turning a thought into a poem and hear about a gigantic garage sale. Don't go away. So how do you know when something you've seen or experienced wants to become a poem?
For me, it's both some kind of resonance, and before I start writing for the day, I do a lot of journaling. And it's not sort of like diary-like. It's much more bits of conversation I found interesting. It's images I saw. Often when we travel, I'm writing down the names of roads or rivers, things like that. And so those all go in there. And there will be times I'll be writing something and it'll trigger another memory and I'll look back and then I'll be like, oh yeah, that also. And so there seems to be something starting to lift a little bit. And I'll go to the computer, I write on the computer and start to toy around with it. And very often, if it's something that I can follow, things start to find their way onto the page pretty quickly. And that's not to say it's easy. It's just, you know, when I found something that's rich, something that is going to become a poem, especially those first few hours are lots of things happening, lots of stuff getting down on the page. And then, of course, it takes days and weeks of revision to shape it. But there's many times I felt like I had something and I've started and nothing got on the page that worked, or there wasn't as much as I thought, perhaps. And that goes in another little folder on the computer and stays there.
So you just have to find a couple of things that start to fit together.
Yeah.
Your poem called Caddo River Elegy. I think this came from a television news story.
Yeah. Again, it's these two things at the same time. One of the reasons I value literature so much is it's so often both and. We have to make room for both things, even when they're contradictory, even when they don't line up, even when they don't seem to make reasonable or logical sense. And that was just as, you know, as we were starting our family and we have these beautiful, needy, you know, little people in our house. And just hearing a news story about a campground in Arkansas, there'd been a flash flood and the Caddo River rose and killed a number of people, including a number of children. There'd been a number of families in the campground. And reading that, I just felt floored. And I carried that around a long time before I tried to write about it. I didn't know how to go about doing that because it felt so, I don't know, so unfair that we were here and whole and healthy and these families out doing what we love to do, out camping along a river, were suddenly broken apart. And I, it just, even now, it's sort of, it's hard to think about. But
is that one you could read?
Yeah, I can read it.
I really like the way you made the images flow.
Great.
It was like reading a river in a way.
Oh, good. Okay. I had to write this in another voice. You know, I didn't feel like me myself, the poet, could make sense of it. So I tried to try it on this voice, the voice of someone who was there, someone who drowned. And so that's where this voice comes from. Caddo River Elegy. And it's got an epigraph, too. At least 16 people, including some children, were killed Friday after flash flood swept through their remote Arkansas campsite. ABCnews.com, June 11, 2010. In the hot dark, we lay like fishes, wet and nosing one another at the gills. In my gut, an old bullfrog thumped. With a whine and haw, a locust sawed at my night heart's moorings. In the earth, I knew, were ancient bones. On the earth were my new bones. I rolled and nosed my yeasty mother, rolled and nosed my bleary, beery father. I forgot exactly where I ended, where the rest began. As if water all around us, as if I were already water, I slid that night into their nostrils, into the heave and hollow of their lungs, ran every crook, slough, and swerve of them. By flapping hearts was driven clean into squinched arterioles. God, I love their bodies. Back to belly in the tent, we lay like fish and breathe the salt rising from each other's skins. What I wouldn't give, I thought, to never sleep but wake, and into each diminishing minute, wake again. Yet as it does, sleep took me, though it took me to the day before the night, to a slow pool of the Caddo River, where with leeches I caught three bream, to that bramble where the blackberries bruised and ran with even the lightest finger, to the slough where I squatted down and watched a turtle blow and settle in the mud until but for his eyes he was mud. Baby was sick and the blowfly sticky, so mother put her in the tent where she slept all day and only squalled when I leaned kindling sticks against a stump and snapped them with my boot. At dinner we fried the bream in peanut grease, boiled greens with tomatoes and bones. Not even mother waited for a bowl. and spoon after spoon, we slurped ice milk straight from the old crank jug. It hurt my teeth, it was so cold. Later, we scrubbed with sand, unlaced our boots, lay down like a row of fishes in the tent. As we dreamed of the good day past, the water came and took us, and we were killed. You might think there would be a buoying. There was no buoying. Like the bad hand of God, water slammed us down, pinned us to the earth, and snapped our every rib. Oh, how does God or anyone bear day and night? I tell you, if this world is a good father's sloping shoulder, the stink of river and ripe blackberries, if this world is a wall of killing water, a man reaching into the flood trees for the small entangled bodies, then goddamn it, then you must best grieve and eat it. A muddy bank of the Caddo River is where I'm dreaming now, where a vole snouts through my throat, where a tree frog's scream fills my heart's dark riffle.
I think that poem is, to me, an example of what a mystery poetry is. Mm. You see something on mm-hmm. TV and you end up with that poem. Yeah. And what comes in between there and you reading that yeah. poem just now is something that nobody that I've talked to in all of these years yeah. has been able to tell me how that happens.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know exactly either, beyond caring and beyond questioning. And then for me, too, is listening for the voice, listening for that music, and trying to let it lead to a certain extent and let go anything I want to say or feel like, you know, trying to let the poem go and do what it needs to do versus me sort of corralling it and forcing it this way or that way. But it is a mystery, I think, in many ways. Absolutely.
And that's what I've heard the best writers say, is that I kind of have to get out of the way
yeah.
and allow the poem to yeah. be what it wants to be.
Right.
Your poem titled The Garage Sale Days Meditations, D-A-Z-E.
Yeah.
There must be a story behind that.
Yeah. So we lived in a little tiny town in Iowa for 6 years, and that's where we started our family. And in the spring, they have, I think actually it might be both spring and fall, but the spring one is the big one. And they have the garage sale days, and it's a big deal. They print an extra edition of the local newspaper, and people will, you have, you know, like an inch and a half, and people write in what they have for sale at such and such an address. You're supposed to open on Friday morning, but sometimes people cheat and open on Thursday night, you know, and they sort of let that slip. And so anyway, it's quite a deal, and people are driving around town all day, all weekend, to different places trying to find the best deals and all sorts of the neat stuff. And this happened to coincide, this garage sale days, with when we were preparing for our son to be born in July. And so that day, Liz, my wife, sent me out with a list of things to get, all having to do with, you know, getting ready his room and getting these things we need. And we really, maybe it's from my mother and my grandmother's influence. My grandmother lived through the Depression and never bought anything if she could help it. And my mother was very similar. And I think I've got that. And it works for Liz and I very often. And so we always try to get things secondhand or used if we can. And so I was hunting the garage sale days for all these things that we needed to be ready.
Well, I'd love to hear that poem. I think we have just enough time
to
squeeze it in before the program's end.
Yeah. So this is the Garage Sale Days Meditations. It's in five parts. One, look at them, slumped in the corner there, ears pounded and mouse bitten, ragged legs askew, rubber lips kissing cold cement. Even here, among the abandoned, they are twice forsaken. The coffee cup, chipped to a wobble, is ever at hand. The faded sweater desires shoulder, sure, but a hanger anyway does the trick. Even that flattened football fairly whistles with tossed potential. What is it that goes out of dolls? They have never been more than what they are. How is it they now look less? Don't look, says the mother, left arm crooked and loaded with a dozen pairs of slacks. Honey, if they scare you, just look the other way. Her little girl knows already we're only going the one way. And so takes the measure of these one-eyed, earless, hacked-ball dolls, takes a step closer, her own rubber soles kissing cold cement. 2. On every one, she's put a price tag. Oh, sure, as old alphabet blocks go, they're good. this clown's lips still strawberry, each tree green and tall. But why is S 20 cents? And why Q or U a dime less demanding? Or Mr. Victory, upright V with your violet ink and predictable violin, why do you deserve not just a dime, but a dozen cents? It doesn't make any sense. Though maybe her first husband was a Leon or a Larry, and that's why L is had now for the linty nickel at the bottom of my pocket. 3. Wayne, it says, on the back of the upright mirror in blue Koran. The woman at the shoebox till, hair crimped and bleached, can't be more than 24. I don't hear a thing from the house. And 2, there are the toys. Yellow dump truck without a wheel, box of just worn baseballs, those few pairs of some small boy's patched-kneed jeans. Where, oh, where can he be? God of garage sales, of Jefferson Airplane 8-tracks, of mismatched rose pattern plates, of shave cream bottles shaped like rocket ships and stilettos red as sour candy, of 16 neon t-shirts imploring one and all to eat at Jake's, of just a dollar, 3 for 1, you won't find another, of all things cold from basement closet corners, of all things wearing a decade's furs of dust, of all things justly and unjustly junked. I pray now, here in this stranger's strange garage, for this one, whose blue name is Wayne. 4. Iowans are easy, all smiles and apologies, but the nicest set of drawers I found belongs to the Italian down the street, all his 80 years and 98 pounds given to rage, rage at whatever idiocy the new day brings. Today, I offer 30. His old face fists, his two fists like birds shot dead. You think my things are not so nice? You think I sell this good thing I bought in Omaha with my own money? Bought when I was young too, when I was man as you. That's what you think? 32.50. You haul it out yourself. 5. It's gotten darker than I hoped. And so after fingering for hours the hidden, homely things of these, my town's men and women, I'm on my way back home. Before I left, you said only what's on the list. And because I love you, I promised. Though right off, I think you'll understand these LPs. Look here. Little Feet's Dixie Chicken couldn't be passed up. The Jimmy Carter coffee cup, that may be a stretch, but it was only 50 cents. And for a buck, I got this charcoal grill shaped like a can of Pabst. Can you believe it? Just a buck. Yes, I found a rocking chair, changing table, swing, and bouncing seat. Yes, now we're ready. Yes, I'm happy as can be. Yes, yes, life is made of cast-off things. God, yes, we need that yellow pail. It's for him to carry things in, whoever he is, whatever he needs to carry.
I love it.
I remember it was one of those days where I sort of in the swirl of here and here and here, I just remember thinking, oh my goodness, the things I've seen today, the things I've heard.
The hidden homely things.
Joe Wilkins lives in Western Oregon, where he teaches writing at Linfield College. You'll find more information about him and his books at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. Also, there are poems and children's book reviews, as well as links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. Just to be sure you don't miss any of these conversations, sign up for our podcast at mtpr.org. Thank you for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridas. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.